This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to speak to G. Caleb Alexander, MD, MS, at the University of Chicago, who's going to talk to us about an article for which he is the corresponding author. The article is called National Trends in Cyclooxygenase 2 Inhibitor Use Since Market Release. It's subtitled Non-Selective Diffusion of a Selectively Cost-Effective Innovation. Welcome to Utopia Media Medical News Network.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why did you undertake this study?
We were interested in exploring this topic for two reasons. The first is knowledge that COX-2 inhibitors are considerably more expensive than non-selective NSAIDs, such as ibuprofen or naproxen. And in many cases, COX-2 inhibitors may be prescribed rather than this other group of NSAIDs. So we were interested in exploring the patterns of use of COX-2 inhibitors, first because of the greater cost of COX-2s. The second reason is that given the relative new release of this class of medicines, we were interested and concerned about possible safety risks associated with the COX-2 inhibitors. Although many people believe that COX-2 inhibitors may be, as a class, more effective than non-selective NSAIDs, their real advantage has been thought to lie in their greater safety among patients who are at high risk of adverse gastrointestinal effects from drugs like ibuprofen or naproxen.
All right, let's talk just a little bit about that medical issue there.
Yeah, I know that was a handful.
Yeah, right. Now, what's the problem with NSAIDs, non-inflammatory, non-selective, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like brand names of Advil, naproxen, or naproxen, or Aleve?
Sure.
What do they do to the stomach lining, and what's the problem there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very widely used class of drugs, and in general, they are both fairly safe and fairly effective. But in a small percentage of people, on the order of 1 to 3% perhaps out of 100, who use these drugs over a long period of time, this small percentage of people can have serious gastrointestinal problems.
Is it only that great? Is it only 1 to 3% of people who are really at risk for...
Well, yeah, that may seem like not that large a number, but
right.
Then if you consider the hundreds of thousands of people that use these drugs,
right.
Many of them using them over long periods of time,
right.
The risks associated with them start adding up.
What percentage of the population is it, would you say, at any risk, even for long-term... after long-term use?
I can't give you an exact statistic, but what I can tell you is that the real enthusiasm behind the release of COX-2 inhibitors was that this new class of drugs would be safer and would therefore reduce the risks associated with the non-selective NSAIDs, such as ibuprofen or naproxen.
Right, and not to beat this point any more than it needs to be, though, it was my understanding, as I was immersed in this issue, that the stomach damaging qualities of these NSAIDs was widespread and everyone was susceptible to it, and that's why it was so important to develop an alternative therapy, the COX-2 inhibitors, that would avoid that problem. And you've just said that 1 to 3% of the population is at risk for severe injury due to this cause, but the other 97% of the people are not very likely or likely to be affected by it? Or
yeah, that's right. I mean, this figure of 1 to 3% is just an estimate, and once again, while that may seem like a relatively small number,
right.
If you're just talking about a one-time event, if you think about the overall number of people using the class of drugs, that's a fairly considerable burden of risk for long-term users, and that's
okay.
That was part of the enthusiasm behind the development of the COX-2.
So there was some point that quote, or vaguely spoke, vaguely described, a lot of people were at risk for a gastrointestinal damage due to the problems associated with the NSAIDs.
Absolutely.
Okay, and that's why the COX-2 inhibitors were developed or marketed, and so what methods did you use to study the populations that were prescribed differentially according to those two drugs?
Sure.
Classes of
well,
drugs?
We took advantage of some data that had already been collected from a large national survey of outpatient office visits. And
right.
this survey is conducted by the National Center for Health Statistics
right.
and is conducted annually. And what the survey does is it samples a certain group of doctors, and then for each of those doctors, looks at all of the patients that visit them during a small length of time during the year. And so this data allowed us to look over several years from 1999 to 2002 at a very large sample of office visits that was nationally representative. In other words, it allowed us to draw conclusions about the likely exposures on a national or population level.
Okay, and essentially the two things you were interested in the patients was what they were prescribed, COX-2s or NSAIDs, and what was their level of gastrointestinal adverse event risks.
That's exactly right. So we were interested both in overall how frequently COX-2s were prescribed rather than non-selective NSAIDs, and
right.
then secondly, we were interested in looking at whether the patients that received COX-2 inhibitors were patients that really stood to gain some advantage from using these drugs over the non-selective NSAIDs.
Okay, so you essentially put the patients into two categories for gastrointestinal events, and was that based on their previous histories?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we initially we placed patients in one of four categories,
okay.
and this was based on a method of separating patients according to risks. Based on their medical history, so things like how old they were, what medical conditions they had, whether they were using blood thinners or whether they were taking a certain type of drug called a steroid, which can damage the stomach lining.
Right.
So we used these various characteristics of patients to separate them into four different categories initially, and these categories were very low risk and low risk and moderate risk and high risk. And these levels capture how much at risk they were from using just the regular non-selective NSAIDs.
Right. Now, these categories were not noted on their records by their doctors.
No.
These were categories calculated by you.
That's exactly
based
right.
Based on data from their medical records.
That's exactly right. And if only they had been noted, one of the challenges of thinking about the implications of our findings is that this information isn't the easiest to automatically calculate for a given patient during a busy 15-minute office visit.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, we can come back to that later, but that's an excellent point.
These
levels were calculated by us.
Ex post facto.
Exactly.
In an idealized or ideal world of medical information, this information would be available at the fingertips of the prescribing physician beforehand, and it would pop up in a four-color-coded green to red expression of what their risk was for adverse gastrointestinal events before
yeah.
they did the prescribing.
That's right. If only, and that's actually one of the promises of electronic medical record systems.
That's right.
Is that at some point in the future, with better information management, we may be able to better help physicians to understand which patients stand to gain the most from a given drug, because no drug is going to benefit all patients the same. There are
right.
some patients that are going to benefit a lot more than others.
And in fact, to overgeneralize from that idealized system, it would pop up green or blue and at low risk, and you could give them NSAIDs, and if it were yellow or red, they would be at high risk, then you might want to give them COX-2s.
That's right.
And obviously you could do that system for any number of other drugs as well, with any number of other constellations of risk factors that you'd calculate.
That's right.
If you had all
That's
that data
right.
available to you. Okay, so what did you find out? Well, how many patients and how many doctors were included in the calculations? Can you say?
Well, we sampled, we used data that sampled just a few thousand patients, but because this was a carefully done statistical survey, we were able to draw conclusions about the overall exposures among the United States population. So
okay.
overall,
right.
we found, for example, that in 1999, there were 15 million patient visits where a COX-2 inhibitor was prescribed.
Okay.
And we found that the use of COX-2 inhibitors increased between 1999 and 2002, so that by 2002, there were 34.6 million visits where a COX-2 inhibitor was prescribed, or more than twice the number than in 1999.
So, and in fact, if you graph the increase in percentage prescription of the COX-2 inhibitors along with the curve for the advertising, you'd get a pretty high correlation, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, our study wasn't designed to examine the impact of advertising on this class of drugs.
Right.
And that is a study that has yet to be done. But I will say that these drugs have been very heavily marketed and promoted both to physicians and patients.
Okay. So the focus on the people who are at the lowest risk for adverse events, the lowest risk of gastrointestinal events, what we were just calling the people in the green and the green and blue categories, what was the trend line for them in terms of getting prescribed the COX-2 inhibitors over this time period?
Yeah, we found that overall about two-thirds of all COX-2 recipients fell into this category. That is, about two-thirds of the prescriptions for COX-2 inhibitors over the time period we examined were for patients that fell into these green or blue categories.
People who didn't stood, really
stood
stand to benefit.
Or nothing to gain from the selective benefit of COX-2s over their less expensive and better studied alternatives.
Well, how is that allowed to happen?
Well,
the scope of your research?
Sure. I mean, that's a complex question and is certainly due to a number of factors. Now, firstly, I should mention that our conclusions are based on some of the assumptions that we made about what proportion of patients fell into each risk category.
Right.
And we did a number of different analyses to try to address this and to try to explore how robust our findings were.
Essentially by defining the categories in slightly different ways.
That's exactly right. And the bottom line was that although the findings varied somewhat depending upon how you defined risk levels,
right,
all of our analyses indicated that over time that the growth in COX-2 inhibitor use occurred primarily among visits where patients stood little or nothing to gain from their selective benefit.
Well, how about the patients who did stand to benefit, who were at higher risk for bad GI events? What was the trend line for their use of COX-2 inhibitors?
Well, we found increases in the proportion of high-risk patients that received COX-2 inhibitors over the time period examined. So it is noteworthy that there were a fair proportion of patients in the high-risk categories that did receive COX-2 inhibitors.
Was it a slower amount of growth than among the people who didn't stand to benefit from it?
The overall rates of growth in the use of COX-2 inhibitors,
right,
across the groups examined varied somewhat, but it increased in all groups examined.
Was the overall increase greater or less than the increase of 63% for the people who didn't stand to benefit from it? See what I'm asking here? In other words, whether even in the group that it was designed to help, that most of those people were put on it right away, and over time, not many more joined that group, and whether almost all of the excess increase was in people who didn't stand to benefit from it.
It's a little bit tricky to answer because there are a number of different ways of looking at the risk levels and changes in use over time.
Right.
So I think the bottom line is that we found we did find a marked increase in the use of COX-2s across all of these patient risk categories.
Right.
And as well, that the majority of the increase in the use of COX-2s was in patients that were low risk for GI problems from non-selective NSAIDs.
So in fact, their rate of adoption of that therapy was greater than the increase in the adoption of this therapy for people who actually stood to benefit from the difference.
Yeah, if I understood you correctly, I think that's the case. Yes.
Okay. In other words, those that were designed that could have benefited from it increased, but not as fast as those who didn't stand to benefit from that aspect of the COX-2 difference. Is what you're agreeing on or saying? Is that right?
If you look at the absolute numbers,
right,
between 1999 and 2002, there was an increase in every risk level examined.
Right.
But approximately two-thirds of the increase was among patients that stood little or nothing to gain.
Okay.
From the selective benefit of COX-2 inhibitors.
Two-thirds of the increase, meaning the
between 1999 and 2002.
Which means, are you saying that 37% of the increase was among people who did stand to benefit from it?
That's exactly right.
Okay. So, in fact, and that ratio is just about 2-to-1 as well.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So, what's the lesson to be learned from this, according to your study?
Well, I think there are a number of lessons. I think there are lessons for policymakers and researchers, and I think there are lessons for patients and for physicians.
Okay, well, start with the patients and work your way up.
Sure. I think for patients and physicians, the real bottom line is that our findings emphasize the importance of patient-physician communication about prescription choice, and that's both regarding the costs of different prescriptions. Out-of-pocket costs are often something that quite naturally patients care greatly about and may be neglected during the course of routine conversations with physicians.
Right.
But so I think our findings emphasize the importance of patient-physician communication both about the cost but also about what's known about the safety and the effectiveness of different drugs. This is particularly true for drugs that are newly released, where there may be a paucity of data regarding their effectiveness and their safety compared with older and much more time-tested treatments.
Well, and in fact, talking about sort of the psycho-marketing dimension of all this, almost all the information that patients get about new drugs is what they see on television and print advertising. Is that, would that be a fair statement?
I think, well, I can't give you a specific
except
figure.
For what they look up on the internet.
Sure. I mean, there are a number of different sources of information for patients about
right.
about drugs. I think that certainly promotion and marketing from radio and from print media is very important.
Right.
And very persuasive. Patients also naturally learn about different medicines from their physicians and other healthcare providers.
And from their friends and associates.
Well, and I was going to say also patients may also learn from, well, firstly that physicians, I mean physician sources of information are different from patient sources.
Right.
For patients alone, I think some of the main sources are promotion and marketing and healthcare providers and friends and family members.
Right. But there aren't people, every time I go to the doctor, someone is wheeling in or wheeling out one of those little suitcases and getting ready to talk to the doctor about their latest drug promotion. And I never see anybody coming in there from anywhere to talk about these kind of issues.
Sure. Well, I mean, this is a very contentious issue, and on the one hand, you know, very vociferous arguments can be made and have been made by many that marketing and promotion efforts play an important educational role for patients and physicians alike.
Right.
And on the other hand, there are equally compelling arguments that these efforts lead to unnecessarily inflated demand for new therapies over old ones, when these new therapies may both cost more and be less safe, less effective, and less time-tested.
Right.
So, you know, there's no question in my mind that these arguments will endure.
Okay. Because I don't want, this may be a slightly far-fetched analogy, but the war in Iraq was precipitated on the grounds that there were weapons of mass destruction there, and we all had to go in and get them. And it turned out there weren't. and the adoption of COX-2 inhibitors was all based on the argument that these are going to save people from the trauma of being exposed to these NASIDs that would cause all kinds of stomach damage. And it turns out from your study that most of the people who got it didn't have that problem at all. And I guess I'm just trying to see whether or not there's some trends, some larger trends here, where people are trying to forward their own agenda by putting forward data that's not necessarily the case.
Sure. Well, I think that we will continue to see considerable debate about the role of advertising in contributing to the overuse that our study documents, as well as the role of FDA oversight and regulation in this process.
And so, and what lessons for those people beyond the physician-patient nexus are you drawing from your findings?
Yeah, well, I think for policymakers, our study has a few take-home points. The first is that evaluations of cost-effectiveness and evaluations of new technologies have to consider the real-world settings in which they're ultimately used.
Okay.
In other words, to do a study in one population of patients that are all, you know, high-risk patients or that may all stand to benefit a lot from a given drug doesn't tell you a lot about the overall balance of public health benefit once the drug is released into the larger population.
Meaning that the COX-2 inhibitors may be very valuable for people who are at high risk for gastrointestinal adverse events, but not everybody is, and therefore the overgeneralization from the data that they're good for that small population ought not to be taken as a carte blanche that everybody needs it.
That's exactly right. I'll give you another example very briefly, which is pap smears.
Right.
There's compelling evidence that pap smears can identify cervical cancer, but when one studies whether they're cost-effective or not as a new technology, it depends upon how frequently they're used. And if they're used on average either too frequently or too infrequently, they no longer become cost-effective. So the first idea, once again, regarding health policy is that evaluations of these new pharmaceutical and other innovations need to consider the real-world settings in which they take place.
And including their cost relative to competing approaches.
That's right. A second take-home point is that, I certainly wouldn't have been the first or the last to argue this, is that that considerable changes are needed in the process of FDA regulation and oversight during the pre-marketing phase, but primarily particularly following approval of a given drug. In other words, the FDA's role in monitoring the safety of COX-2s and in evaluating the cardiovascular risks associated with them clearly doesn't stop at the time of market approval. And in fact, for many drugs, if not all drugs, there are considerable lessons that can only be learned after the drug has been released, because it's only then that you have a large enough population that's using the drug to study some of these outcomes.
And this is particularly important in view of what's called off-label prescribing, right?
That's exactly right. And so off-label prescribing is this idea that even though a drug is approved for one indication, say mild to moderate pain, physicians are allowed to use the drug for another indication, another reason. And off-label prescribing is very common. There are many, many examples of drugs where even though they're approved for one condition, doctors may use them for another condition.
So essentially the problem is that if a drug company can get the FDA to approve their product for even the most narrow of uses, they are then legally entitled to go out and advertise directly to consumers, to physicians, and say, this is good for you, and it's a legal drug, you ought to be taking it, and there's really nothing under current law or practice to stop them from doing that.
I don't believe, actually, that that's fully correct. In other words, I believe, but I'm not certain that the marketing and promotion of a drug is limited to the indications for which it's approved.
Oh, okay. You mean the prescribing is allowed, but not marketing?
That's exactly right. So if a drug is approved to treat seizures, I do not believe that it can be marketed for chronic pain, but that does not mean that that there may not be studies that suggest it's useful for that, or that physicians, in fact, adopt the medicine largely for this off-label indication.
Does it mean a bunch of physicians can be invited off to the Bahamas for a relaxing weekend and told that it's great for these other 12 maladies that haven't been tested by the FDA?
I do not believe that the level of marketing and promotion for a drug. I believe that the level of marketing and promotion for a drug is limited to the indications for which it's approved, but nevertheless.
So how does all the off-label prescribing happen?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think further studies need to be done to flesh out some of the ways that drugs may be adopted beyond the indications for which they're initially approved. One point here that I think is important to note is that that physicians and patients too have considerable brand loyalty. That is that that it's difficult. You know, there are thousands of drugs that are available for use. Even for take a common treatment like a common condition like hypertension.
Right.
There are over 100 different drugs that can be used for high blood pressure. Now, studies have suggested that most physicians, naturally, will become familiar with and use only a small number of those drugs.
Right.
And so, therefore, in that process, which is only understandable, and I think in everybody's best interest for physicians to become familiar, really well familiar with drugs and to know the adverse effects associated with them, but in that process, it's possible that that drugs end up being used beyond the conditions for which they were initially improved.
Okay. Does any of this argue to you that it would be appropriate to break up in the same way that the Atomic Energy Commission used to be in charge of regulating and promoting nuclear power, that the FDA ought to be broken up into a part that approves drugs and a part that monitors them once they have been approved according to the criteria that you've been investigating here and other criteria to see whether they need to stay on the market or whether their prescribing needs to be limited in some way?
Very, very good question. And there have been a number of renowned national health policy experts and clinicians that have suggested just such a separation of powers within the FDA, the argument being that the advisory committees that are responsible for approving a drug have an inherent and inevitable potential, if not actual, conflict of interest, such that after having carefully reviewed evidence and made recommendations and finally given market approval for a drug, that invariably they may have a potential or actual conflict of interest and therefore not be unbiased and therefore not be the right party to actually evaluate post-marketing reports of danger.
Dangerously enough, meaning that if they've stamped it with their imprimatur of safety and effectiveness, they're going to be very reluctant to admit that they were wrong, and as a result they might refrain from indicating that they were wrong, with the effect being that a lot of people continue to take the drugs.
Well, that's
essentially what seems to have happened, or is argued by some has happened, with the COX-2 inhibitors.
That's exactly right. It would be as if I asked you to go out and recommend, after careful review and assembling your own advisory panel, I asked you to recommend the top car that you thought was best for safety and for transportation.
Right.
And then after your evaluation, your careful selection, you know, there comes a concern down the road, and I approach you with it, and I expect you to lead the evaluation of the safety after you've already come up with this conclusion.
And so if the wheels fall off of a lot of them, you're going to be reluctant to point that out, which means a lot of people will keep buying the cars with the wheels that fall off, and there you go.
Well, that's quite possible.
All right. So what's the bottom line in all this? What are you recommending that the people take away from this study?
Yeah, just a few basic messages. The first is we found marked increases in the use of COX-2 inhibitors over the time period examined.
Right.
The second main finding was that the majority of increases in the use of COX-2 inhibitors occurred among patients who stood little or nothing to gain from their selective benefit. The implications of this is that many patients were exposed to unnecessary health risks, as well as the increased cost of these medicines with little or nothing to gain. So for patients and physicians, this emphasizes the importance of communication and careful decision-making regarding prescription choice. And for policymakers, it emphasizes the importance of considering how new pharmaceutical innovations diffuse through a population, and as well the role of the FDA in the approval and post-approval regulation process.
Okay, so there's something for everyone to take away from this and hopefully move into a new era of medical communication in which a lot of these things are clear to everyone and better decisions can be made.
I think so, slowly but surely.
All right. Well, part of it is researchers like you explaining to the public what's at stake, and I want to thank you for doing that today on Utopia Media Medical News Network.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.